Alrighty, so welcome.
Welcome, everybody.
And we're really excited about this and enthusiastic about some innovations that we've found regarding the HPA axis and some of the ideas that have been perpetuated in the field of integrative medicine around adrenal fatigue issues. We're going to really debunk a lot of those myths and really start to rethink adrenal fatigue and understand a little more deeply the physiology of stress. And before we dive into what we're going to cover, I think it's really important that we start to understand just a little bit about how the physiology of stress and working with stress in the clinical setting has been something that's been really only in the past decade accepted into conventional care model, and integrative care has really pioneered this field, but it's now solidly researched. We have tons of solid research on HPA axis. We have tons of solid research on meditation and the effects of meditation and mindfulness practice towards health benefits. And I was just listening to a talk by a conventional doc who's switched over to a functional approach, and he was talking about how if you'd asked him 10 years ago, and he's an Alzheimer researcher, if you'd asked him 10 years ago if he thought that he would be talking about meditation and stress and a functional approach, he would have laughed at you. But today he's really seeing, you know, he's following the research. A lot of people who are up to date on the research are realizing that this is such an incredibly important dimension of healthcare. And instead of just having the three pillars of nutrition and fitness and sleep, now we're seeing a fourth pillar of stress management and mindfulness practice and perception of stress being absolutely critical for health and well-being. But there's still a lot that we need to understand about the physiology of stress, about how to work with stress, and about how to apply clinically stress management and HPA axis regulation practices in a way that's not just telling people to go home and meditate. So we want to find out, how do we do that?
So, and then notice that Miles is saying HPA axis dysregulation a lot. We have adrenal fatigue written in the title here because that's what's the commonplace as far as the verbiage that we're seeing. People, our clients, people on Google, people on Facebook, the community talking about. One thing we're going to talk about over and over this weekend is rethinking the term adrenal fatigue. Because when we start understanding the physiology and start understanding how to work with stress, the perception of stress in the adrenals, what we're going to find is that the adrenals are actually not fatigued. It's not a muscular fatigue type of thing where it's a problem with the gland itself. We're going to see there's much, when we get into the root, there's much more of HPA axis dysregulation, of cortisol resistance, of communication between the trifecta of the glands, of the hypothalamus, pituitary, and the adrenals that are really at play here. So, and with that being said, let's look at what we are going to learn.
We're going to start with the big picture. See, we're going to start with the big picture because the big picture gives us that 10,000 foot overview where we can look down and we can see, why is this important? We can explain to clients why it's worth their time, money, energy, and effort to investigate, and we'll be able to have a sense for context through which we can dive into some of the details. And so we're going to kind of start zoomed out. We'll zoom into some details, and then we'll zoom back out at the end to give us an understanding of how to integrate into clinical practice.
We're going to go into functional physiology. Functional physiology is going to be really important. We're going to look at things like the pregnenolone steal and what we're finding in the research that is showing that the pregnenolone steal is not really happening in the way that we once thought it was. We're also going to spend some time with the adrenal medulla. It's a part of the adrenal scenarios that is not often talked about and is very wrapped into adrenal dysregulation. Mm-hmm. And then also looking at how things like circadian rhythm and sleep function also tie into the adrenals as well. So really looking at the physiology on how the adrenals are deeply functioning within context of other glands and organs.
Then we're going to talk about body root causes. So we're going to look into what are some of the functional issues that can arise in...
You skipped one ahead.
Oh, so before we do that, we're going to talk about the HPA axis, what that is, how that relates to stress, how that's a better term if we're talking research and we're talking to research-based practitioners and clinicians for rather than adrenal fatigue. We'll talk about why that is. We're going to talk about symptoms of HPA axis dysregulation, and we're going to talk about how the HPA axis connects to other systems in the body, and so that we can look at when we're dealing with other issues that people have that don't seem like stress-related issues, that we can talk about the connection to the HPA axis and encourage people still to see why it's important to manage stress.
Then we're going to talk about body root causes and going through them one by one and just looking at what is the core of why the adrenals get dysregulated, why HPA axis function happens. And when it comes down to treatment, we're going to see that the understanding the core root causes are really necessary in understanding how we actually approach this clinically.
Then we're going to go over mind root causes, which are big in any area of health and particularly impactful within context of the HPA axis. It's really important to address mind root causes by doing supplements and nutrition stuff, and some lifestyle stuff alone usually isn't enough unless people are really diligent about their lifestyle practices. So we really need to look at what are the underlying mind root causes. We need to look at perception of stress. That's going to be a huge part of working with the HPA axis, and there are many other mind root causes that we'll cover as well, but particularly perception of stress is going to be so, so important if we're going to help someone to recover from HPA axis imbalance.
Then we'll look at lab testing. In particular with lab testing, we're going to be looking at differences between urinary, salivary, serum levels of cortisol and DHEA, why certain of those types of specimen have more of an advantage or a disadvantage than others.
And then we're going to talk about body root cause treatment, and we're going to get into the kinds of things that we can do. And because the physiology of stress is so complex, the treatment gets a little bit complex, but we're going to boil it down, make it as simple as we can by categorizing things into different categories so that you can see on labs two or three different things going on, and then you can have an idea about how to treat each one, and then you can put them together in a custom program for your client based on their supplement tolerance and what they're interested in engaging with in terms of the lifestyle practices and some of the mindfulness one-on-one work.
And then looking at mind root causes, same sort of thing. So we'll go through talking about the mind causes and then how we actually begin to treat them. How do we work with the mind root causes in our clinical practice and also within ourselves? A lot of the mind root causes, like so many things, we're going to see that when we start to apply them to our own life, we're going to be able to talk to others about them a little bit more easily.
And then again, we'll zoom out. We'll see how do we apply this to our own lives? How do we apply this in our clinical practice? And how can we make our understandings about the physiology of stress become something that informs the way that we live in the world? So the big picture.
So why are we here? Why are we studying HPA axis dysregulation? Look at these statistics. 72% of Americans feel stressed about money sometimes. 22% rates your financial stress on an 8+ out of a 10-point scale. We're seeing a lot of stress around finances, varying degrees. But, you know, say a quarter almost of the country feels that 8 out of 10 for finances. So this is a big thing that we need to work with people. How do they view money? How do they view paying bills? What is their perception of money? What is their perception of finances? 20% skip or consider skipping doctor visits due to money. This is also another huge thing for us to know as holistic care practitioners, how much people are, the way they're perceiving stress is actually impacting them showing up and then showing up again and again and again. 29% say they have loneliness and isolation due to stress. So we're going to see as we go through some of these root causes that social isolation has a big impact on how we can handle stress. It actually has a big impact on serotonin and dopamine levels. And if we're saying almost a third of people are experiencing loneliness and isolation already because of stress, that's a little bit of a vicious cycle. The loneliness and the isolation can impact serotonin and dopamine, which is going to make them more stressed. But stress is causing them loneliness and isolation. So we get a little bit of a circuit there.
And I want to add something about that. What's interesting is that with social stress and loneliness and isolation, we live in a world where technology has gotten to a point that connects us together. We're having the capacity to speak to people across the world. We have things that maybe 20 years ago, even 10 years ago, were things of the wild imagination, like video phones. And we can now speak to people and see them at a distance very simply, very easily, very affordably. It's almost in most people's pockets, in our culture at least. And yet we have this isolation. People live often in big cities. Often there's tons of people around them. Yet there can be this feeling of loneliness. It's almost like we're living in an island of a home within a large network that we can get disconnected from, and it's easy to not know our neighbors, and it's easy to not connect with other people and simply focus on going to our job and coming back home and doing something in isolation, like watching TV or doing something by ourselves. And so there's this real stigma and this real issue, even though we're in this very connected society technologically, even though we've got these amazing cities where we have all these people really close together and all of these opportunities to get together and to meet up, our culture is much less socially oriented. We don't raise children in communities in the same way that we used to on average as a culture, and we don't have the same level of connection with the family unit in our culture as many other cultures do. And so there's a lot of reasons why that's a big deal. We see in blue zones, in those places where people are living to be 100 plus at a much higher rate, where sometimes the average lifespan is in the 90s, which is higher than the 78 average lifespan in the US. Often one of the key factors that's isolated from those places is less about diet, less about things that we would think like smoking or big risk factors, and more about social connection and more about communities of people getting together and people having purpose within that community and sustaining that purpose into their old age. Our culture tends to take the elderly in our culture tend to be put in homes and isolated further, and they're retired and they don't have that purpose of work, and they're often isolated from the rest of the society, and they're not considered to be the sort of wise advisors and contributors to society that they are in many other cultures. So there are some programs that are helping to change that, but we just have this, I just want to bring this bigger picture to the loneliness and social isolation, because it's a little bit strange in the context of our culture, but it's absolutely there with almost a third of people experiencing that.
I don't think we need to read through all of these, but the point of this is that we have a huge degree of stress that is related to things like sleep dysregulation, social isolation, finances, and that stress is a big deal. And the way we're perceiving these things, these challenges in life, is going to really impact our adrenals and other areas of our health.
So a few more things that, 41% report yelling at their loved ones due to stress. I mean, that's a little bit sad, but it's something that it's worth noting that stress pushes people to do things that they wouldn't want to do if they were thinking clearly. And if they haven't learned to manage stress and shift perceptions around it, they can really do things that they regret later. And so 41% is a pretty shocking statistic on that. And we see some differences between women and men here. And we see social isolation and loneliness increasing all-cause mortality being a significant contributor. In fact, it's estimated to be at the equivalency of about 15 cigarettes per day as a risk factor for all-cause mortality, which is incredibly profound and shocking that every doctor in the U.S. at least has pretty much a very strong training in knowing that smoking is one of the biggest possible risk factors for disease and goes a long way to try to educate and inform. It's a big issue in public health, and yet we see social isolation, which hasn't yet gotten that kind of status in the public health world, being an equivalent risk factor. So that's really important.
So you're saying that stress equals 15 cigarettes a day?
We're saying that social isolation. So social isolation has been, there's a recent paper that came out that looked at social isolation in a large group of individuals and found that the all-cause mortality increased respectively for people who were socially isolated versus people who were socially connected in an equivalent percentage to people who smoke 15 cigarettes per day.
So this next one we're looking at, psychological stress seen with increases in all-cause mortality. Notice we're saying psychological and not physiological here. So what we're really saying, and what we see across so many of these studies, is that a lot of studies are looking at perceived stress, and that what they're finding is that if a couple different groups of people have the same stressors, but one sees them as a stress and the other sees them as something else, the group that's going to be more affected is the group that has the perception of stress that is negative. And we're seeing this all across the research, that it's not, and it's allowing us to see that it's more than just what the stressor is. And certainly there's, certain stressors like motor vehicle accidents that are going to be, they're going to be traumas and stressful on the body no matter what. But we're seeing enough evidence around the perception of stress that we are definitely theorizing that in situations such as motor vehicle accidents, that even if the body has that stressor, that how we perceive that, if we look at that as, wow, this is a challenge, but I can come back and rebuild my body stronger than before, and we're looking at it as a chance to maybe be at home more while we're recovering, whatever the attitude is, that perhaps we can start healing from things faster, and perhaps we can at least have the negative part of the stress response removed because of our perception being different.
So, what will determine a stress response? So, here's a nice model with an acronym that can help us to understand a little bit about what a stress response is that might be impactful to us. So, number one, novelty to the individual. Novelty meaning it's something that's not expected, it's new, it's fresh, it's not something that someone's counting on happening.
And then how predictable or unpredictable it is. Did we have in our consciousness an idea that things would go this way? Or was it a shock to the system that we now have to incorporate this new thing? Is it completely unpredictable?
And the difference between the two is that the novelty is something that it's a new type of experience versus the unpredictable, we didn't predict it. So with novelty, there's this sense of if we have an unpredicted thing, but we've had those kinds of things happen many times before, we're generally less stressed out by it. But if it's novel, if it's unpredictable and it's novel, something that we don't usually experience, then that can be throwing us a little bit more for a loop.
public speaking, I think, is a good example of this because a lot of people get very stressed about public speaking. But public speaking is one of these things that most of us know we're going to do. So it's not going to be unpredictable, you know, most of the time. But if it's our first or second or third time speaking in public, it's going to be very novel. So, and say we're in a setting where somebody calls on us out of the blue to stand up and give a speech, and we weren't predicting that, now we're adding an extra layer to, say, the amount of stress that could be caused because it's novel then and it's unpredictable.
And then threat to the person or ego. Of course, if it's threat to physically ourselves, that our body, that's one thing that can absolutely be stressful, or it can also be a threat to our ego, to our sense of identity, if it's something that we had, you know, someone's, if we perceive or we think that someone's attacking us, if we feel like we need to defend ourselves, if we feel like our honor or reputation is at stake, if we feel like we've been unfairly treated, those are all things that can contribute to this response.
And then loss of sense of control. We're going to talk a lot about the sense of control later. The idea that we can, as humans, control our external environment is a little bit, it can cause a lot of stress because in actuality, we can't necessarily control our external environment. What we can control is our reaction to it, our internal state with whatever is going on around us. But if we feel, if something happens and we feel a sense of loss of having control internally or externally, that can definitely create more of a stress response.
So if NUTS is an acronym that can help us to remember these four factors that might be impactful in considering what would qualify as a stress response, that we can still have a healthy stress response to these types of situations, but it's a stress response. And we'll talk about the difference between a healthy and an unhealthy stress response. These help to get that sense of if something qualifies as a stress response. Stress has been shown to cause reversible cardiomyopathy.
What?
So as well as a decrease in the cardiac ejection fraction. So we're definitely seeing stress affecting the heart. Again, some of the studies that I've looked at here regarding cardiomyopathy and cardiac ejection fraction have to do with perception of stress.
Changes to coronary arteries and the cardiac walls. One of the big preventive tests that's being used these days for cardiovascular illness is called a CIMT, or a carotid intima media thickness ultrasound. Basically, an ultrasound to the carotid artery is a really nice way of assessing plaque and thickness of the wall. And the thickness of the wall of the artery is correlated to some extent with age of person. So that's how they, in those labs, rate the thickness, is they give you a cardiovascular age, essentially. So when you look at that thickness of the wall, it tends to get thicker and thicker as people age. And we know cardiovascular events get more and more likely as people age. So there's definitely a correlation between the intima media thickness of the artery walls and the level of risk for cardiovascular events and illness. And so we see that stress really plays a role. And if we're doing some, if someone has a risk factor for cardiovascular illness, or if so the cholesterol starts to get out of whack, or if we see inflammatory markers in the cardiovascular system, and we recommend often that people will go get a CIMT, and it's probably a reasonable screening for nearly everyone to get at a certain age, and there's a really good correlation between the carotid artery and the arterial system in the rest of the body, and it's non-invasive, fairly non-invasive because it's an ultrasound, and we really see that thickness could be affected by stress. So if someone's cardiovascular age in that report is higher than their true age, and we see that their thickness is more than we would expect for their age, we might be looking at stress as one of the root causes there.
The typical times we're going to send somebody for a carotid ultrasound is going to be when we're seeing certain things on blood work, such as elevation in LPPLA2, which is talking about the plaque on the arteries, or certain forms of lipids, such as OxLDL or small dense LDL. So when we're seeing a lipid profile that looks a little dysregulated, that's when we start wondering about the cardiac age. And when we get those reports back, it's because of this sort of stuff that it's really important to talk about stress.
And then we see that 2/3 of women die of heart disease have no previous symptoms. So this is really important, and you know, it's something that rings true for me, being having a history where my father passed on from a heart attack when I was 15, and we didn't see it coming. And he was an MD with top-notch medical training from Stanford, and he did his master's of public health at Yale. He had really top-notch conventional training, and yet he had a heart attack without seeing it coming, with not getting those many previous symptoms to be able to warn us about that. But with some of the screening and testing that we have available to us now, we don't need those symptoms necessarily. We can really assess and identify cardiovascular risk a long time before there are symptoms in most cases. We can really see the labs changing, especially with some of the more comprehensive profiles that we're able to get with things like LPPLA2, some of the inflammatory markers, OxLDLs, small dense LDLs, breaking those things down, looking at CIMTs. Those things are all absolutely fantastic.
So looking at heart disease death rates, this is 2011 to 2013, and we're seeing some of these areas, we're at, what are those numbers over there, Miles? I can't read.
So the white 67 to 224 in these white areas, and then 224 to 250 approximately in the very light red, and then 259 to 294 in the sort of orange, darker orange, 294 to 343 in the light red areas, and 343 to 931 in the really dark red areas. Then there are a few that have insufficient data, but most of them, you see the data here.
And that's for every 100,000 people?
Yep, yeah, that's annual rates, so yearly rates per 100,000 people. So in some areas, we have nearly, you know, between 343 and 931 out of 100,000 every year passing from cardiovascular incidents. Stress has been shown to contribute to an increase in obesity. These numbers have increased rapidly in the past 20 years, and we're really finding that blood sugar dysregulation is one of the key drivers, which is also correlated and connected with the HPA axis. And we have this, what we would call a diabesity epidemic. We see diabetes rates rising dramatically. We see obesity rates rising dramatically. And we can see the connection between the two, so that we can even coin, there's a term that's been coined called diabesity, where we're really talking about this epidemic that's really moving in a direction that's incredibly alarming and that's absolutely preventable through nutrition, lifestyle, and mindfulness practice. And so we can absolutely work with this epidemic, but its trajectory is headed in the direction of being incredibly impactful. It's really, we see childhood obesity going way, way up. We see rates of diabetes going way, way up, including in children, and the trajectory is moving in the direction of it being an issue for a third, if not a half, of people in the not too distant future, in just a few decades from now.
And then in interest of keeping things light and non-stressful in here as we talk about some complicated information.
Talking about heavy things.
So we'll be breaking up the lecture all weekend and just trying to intersperse it with a little humor. So we'll see this throughout the weekend. Funniest things heard at a doctor's office. And this one is, here, says the nurse, handing the patient a urine specimen container. The bathroom's over there. And a few minutes later, the patient comes out of the bathroom and says this, "Thanks," and returns the empty container. "But there was a toilet in there, so I didn't actually need this after all."
Nice.
So, does stress impact our health negatively? Is stress good, bad, or simply neutral? This pulls upon Hans Selye's work. And Hans Selye was looking at the difference between distress and eustress. And it was basically looking at the concept that stress itself is neutral. This comes back to the idea of perception of stress like we're talking about. So if we have an incident that occurs, it is how we look at that incident, it is how we perceive that incident that's going to help determine if it's good, a good stress, eustress, or bad stress, distress. And what his work showed was there was differences in how we would physiologically respond to the stress. So there'd be changes in our body. Our body would seemingly have a cortisol rise, no matter if it was a eustress or distress. The long-term effects of what that cortisol was doing were different if it was distress or eustress. And we're still seeing this concept play out in the current research. This research, his work was back, I believe, in the early 1970s. And we're still seeing in the current research this idea show up again and again and again as we do these studies around perceived stress.
We are seeing a lot of things that Hans Selye was saying change as we understand more about the physiology, but some of the things are still perpetuating today. And I've been giving talks about stress for a few years now, and I generally pull the room. And before I show a slide like this, I'll say something like, how many people in this room believe that I tell people, first, rate your stress low, moderate, or high. And then I ask people to raise their hand who think they have low stress overall, people who think they have moderate stress, people who think they have high stress. And it's usually a minority that think they have low stress. It's usually the majority think they have either moderate or high stress. And then I ask, how many people believe that stress impacts their health negatively? And it's almost always unanimous. It's almost always every single person in the room. Once in a while, there's one person or two people who were ones that raised their hand when they said they had low stress, who won't raise their hand when they say, do they believe that stress is impacting their life negatively? But on average, it's in our culture, there's an idea of stress is bad. I want to push it away and eliminate it and get rid of it. The idea is not necessarily about, I mean, the term stress management is in our culture, but a lot of people think about stress elimination. They want to get rid of it. They want to eliminate it. They want to remove it from their lives. And when we look at the Merriam-Webster definition, which is in our dictionary, we can see a little bit about why this is. A state of mental tension and worry from problems in your life, work, etc. Tension and worry are associated with the word stress in the very first definition in Merriam-Webster. This is in our culture deeply. The second definition, something that causes strong feelings of anxiety, causes strong feelings of anxiety. Like, we don't have any say. Like, we can't respond to a challenge as finding it fun. Like, we can't stay calm and relax in the face of struggles and difficulties that we're facing. Causes strong feelings of anxiety. So this is really interesting. We're going to look more into an externalized locus of control in mind root causes, but it's in the dictionary. Then we see physical force or pressure. Well, yes, I can stress this wall so much that it breaks. That's another definition of stress. So a really good example of a eustress on the physical side of things is weightlifting. We stress our bodies. We actually break down muscle tissue. We push ourselves beyond our comfort zone. We stress our body enormously. We get sore afterwards. But then we know that we're going to grow stronger. We know that our body's going to produce more muscle as a result. We can have that same sort of capacity in the mental-emotional sphere. We can have a stress that pushes us outside of our comfort zone that makes us sore mentally and emotionally, that we can grow stronger from. We can have more mental muscle as a result. So that would be a eustress. And a distress would be something we're just continuously circling, mulling about over and over in our head. We can't shake it, and we're feeling like it's keeping us up at night, and we're worrying about it obsessively. But stress in and of itself is neutral, and if you can walk away with just that already, that's going to be huge for HPA axis regulation. If you can convince and help your clients to understand, stress in and of itself is neutral. Their perceptions of it and how they relate to challenge and struggle in their lives determine whether that stress makes them stronger or causes illness. They have some say.
So what is stress? So one definition, just thinking about other definitions, one definition is a circumstance that pushes people out of their comfort zone. So we're going to see later when we go into the mind root causes that a big thing for people is familiarity. That one of the biggest things that we resist as humans is change. And one of the biggest impulses for humans is to stay in what is familiar. So things that are going to push people out of their comfort zone, whether it is new jobs or new family situations or moves or learning a new skill, even some of these things that we're saying, this could be good, learning a new skill, it can still show a stress. Doesn't have to be a distress, it could be a eustress. But if we're going outside of our comfort zone, that is going to put some sort of pressure on the body to respond. We're going to see that with stresses, from a physiological standpoint, we're going to get an increase in catecholamines. We're going to see changes in dopamine and epinephrine and norepinephrine. And we're going to see changes in cortisol. We're also going to see changes in DHEA. So all of these neurotransmitters, these hormones, are going to be typically altered with stress.
And just as a clinical aside for the catecholamines, even though in the U.S. typically epinephrine and norepinephrine are the medical terms that are used, for some reason the popular understanding in the common public is more about adrenaline. People have heard of adrenaline, which is more used in Europe medically, but it's an okay term to use to talk about adrenaline when we're talking about catecholamines to clients especially, who don't have the medical terminology. So we can just, instead of norepinephrine, epinephrine, we can say adrenaline or adrenaline. And that's just a little clinical pearl that clients will understand a little bit more easily.
So then we're saying that research shows that it's less about the stress and more about how the stress is perceived. So again and again and again, perception of stress is huge. So when we're working with our clients around stress, because of the culture that we're in and because of things like the dictionary definition that we just showed you, it's really important that we talk to our clients, our patients about this concept, because it's built into our culture that stress is bad. So it's going to be incredibly important that we tell them about this research, that it's really about the perception of stress that we're seeing as the biggest problem in how stress actually affects our physiology.
We're going to come back to this over and over and over again because we all need reminders, being in the culture that we're in. We need reminders, and we need it to get ingrained deeply, and we need to be able to have conversations with clients about it.
And then we've already talked about the eustress and distress thing. So we've been talking about studies. Here's one. 43% higher risk of premature death in those who thought stress was negative.
And,
go ahead.
Oh, and if you want to see more about this study and really hear a talk that's very, very well done, you can search How to Make Stress Your Friend by Kelly McGonigal. It's a TED Talk. And she spends most of that talk talking about three studies, and this is one of those three. And she does an excellent job at helping people to understand perception of stress. So that's actually a really good support activity to give clients, is to watch that TED Talk, because it doesn't always have to come from you if you don't have time in the clinical setting to really go into detail. You can just briefly mention that perceived stress is much more. So people, basically, you can say with this study that the two groups of people who had the same stress rate were the people who had low stress, the same death rate were the people who had low stress, and the people who had high stress but didn't believe that that stress was negatively impactful to their health. However, the people who had high stress and did believe that stress was negatively impactful to their health had that 43% higher risk.
What, Kelly who?
McGonigal. So it's exciting, right? Because what this means is that it puts the power back in our hands. We've already mentioned this idea of externalized locus of control, of feeling like the stress is happening to us and we have no control over it. But knowing that the perception of stress actually impacts things, it makes us less a victim. It puts us into powerful positions because we realize that we actually do have an internal locus of control. We actually can, from our internal state, change how we react to stress, how we perceive stress, what we're going to do about stress. So we actually do have the power in this, you know, study example to change how we're perceiving stress and therefore change risk of things like premature death.
And if I'm remembering correctly, I believe this study had over 8,000 people in it. So it was a big study too. Now correlative, but big and pretty significant. It also means we need to help our clients realize they have power too. They have some say. If in their mind stress happens to them and causes them strong feelings of anxiety and causes them to react and yell at their spouse, then they're going to do those things. And it will be a problem for them. It will be a self-fulfilling prophecy if that's their belief. Generally, for the most part, that's going to play out in their lives. If, however, we're able to help them to reframe their understanding of stress, how they perceive stress, that it's neutral and that they can have a say, that when struggle hits, that they can use that struggle to clarify what's important to them, to take a reassessment of their life and what they're doing, to reprioritize the things that matter the most to them, to look into their heart and see what they're passionate about and move towards that. Then people are going to have a sense that they can get stronger from struggle. And often people look back on some of the most significant struggles that they've had. If they've had enough time and reflection and perspective on it, often people look back and realize that that made a significant difference for them, pushed them in a direction that was really meaningful and helped them to shape their lives and find purpose and meaning. So stress can be, and struggle can be, channeled towards finding purpose and meaning.
Like we said, this is a big topic. We're talking about changing people's deep-rooted habits, deep-rooted beliefs, deep-rooted emotions around stress. So we'll go, when we get to the mind treatment section, we're going to go more in detail about how we actually do work with people and try to get them out of their habits and change their beliefs and emotions. It's a big topic.
Part two, functional physiology.
So we always like to start here when we do functional physiology, just to remind ourselves why we're reviewing the basics. here with adrenal glands, one of the big reasons is what because we're finding that some of the old research has been trumped by the newer research around adrenal function, around the physiology, around things like we mentioned, the pregnenolone steel. We're also going to see that the three-stage model is outdated, that doesn't really show up in the research that we move through three stages of adrenal fatigue. So we're going to look at, it's going to be really important that we understand the physiology behind adrenal function, because that's going to help us explain and help us understand why some of this research is now saying there's actually another mechanism of action happening here.
And we're going to get new insights into the physiology of stress that are going to help us to be able to, you know, a lot of our clients at least come in and they're doing their own research. They get to us after they've been to a lot of different practitioners and they've done a lot of research themselves, and they come in with ideas and understandings. And if we can have these newest understandings and insights into things like the physiology of stress, we're going to really be able to show the clients who come in with some basic research about understanding something like pregnenolone steel or adrenal fatigue, and we're going to be able to educate them about a newer, more accurate understanding of the physiology of stress, and that's going to really impress people, and that's going to help people trust that we're an authority, that we're investigating deeply into these matters, and that we're dedicating our life to this, and help people to understand that just a few minutes or even a few hours of online research doesn't compare to someone who's really passionately putting the majority of their career energy and life energy towards making this study of health and wellness a primary part of their lives. And so it's important that people understand that, so that they understand that us as practitioners have some insights that they may not be able to just get by Googling things and doing a few hours of research.
So remember that the adrenal glands, just the basics are, they sit on top of the kidneys, they secrete hormones. There's that outer cortex, which has three zones. We're going to learn that each of the zones are going to secrete different hormones. So this is going to be very important in understanding why the pregnenolone steel does not exist. We're also going to see, we're going to go deeper into the medulla, and the medulla that secretes catecholamines, so the inner part of the adrenal glands. This is also going to be really interesting for us, because we're going to learn that the adrenal cortex and the adrenal medulla, there is actually some communication between the two, and the hormone levels of the cortex actually do affect the hormone levels of the medulla. So we're going to look at that interplay between them.
So the cortex has the three zones, and these three zones produce different hormones. So the zona glomerulosa, that's the outer zone and produces aldosterone, which is regulatory for urine and blood pressure. We have the zona fasciculata, which is the middle zone, produces cortisol and progesterone. And then the zona reticularis is the inner zone, that produces DHEA, estrogen, and testosterone. Primarily, we're going to look at the cortisol production in the fasciculatae, and primarily for the reticularis, we're going to look at DHEA, dehydroepiandrosterone production, but it's important to know that these others are also produced. That'll help us understand the relationship with the sex hormones and the HPA axis.
So in the medulla, very interesting, we learned that the medulla is connected to the subiculum of the hippocampus. And the subiculum is interesting because it also communicates with the amygdala. So remember, the hippocampus is where we form memories, store memories. There's a lot of memory association with the hippocampus. And the amygdala, remember, is emotions and fear. So it makes sense then that we have the amygdala connected through the subiculum to the adrenal medulla. So when we have a fear or an emotion, through connecting to the subiculum, we have a connection to the secretion of these catecholamines.
Is that a connection through nerves?
It's connection through nerves. Correct. Yep, and it's also going to be interesting because the medulla is connected. So the catecholamines we can look at is almost connected to the subiculum of the hippocampus. So we can think about, wow, this trigger that we have that reminds us of a past event. We have this memory of it pop into our head, and all of a sudden we feel all stressed out. Well, it's because the part of the hippocampus and the hippocampus regulating memory is actually connected to the medulla where the catecholamines are. So, you know, one of the classic examples of this is somebody who's been in a fighting territory, who's been in something like the military where they're used to gunshots. And then all of a sudden a car backfires and their heart is racing and maybe they jump back. Well, what's happening, one of the things that's happening is we get that memory, that car backfiring is re-triggering that memory. And because this part of the hippocampus is connected to the medulla, all of a sudden we get that signal due to that memory, and the catecholamines are released.
And remember that we can, when talking to clients, use adrenaline and noradrenaline instead of epinephrine and norepinephrine. Also with the catecholamines, for speaking with clients, it's often helpful to give them something that they understand in their experience to be able to relate to an idea or concept that we're talking about. So for the catecholamines, we can relate them to an experience of, for example, most people have had the experience of driving along and someone cuts them off and they have to slam on the brake and they get this whoosh of energy where they feel like, whoa, that I just had to respond really quickly, and they feel a little bit freaked out for a short amount of time and then it dissipates and they feel a little bit better. Maybe they're a little bit shaken. But that is a catecholamine cascade type of response. So someone gets that rush of adrenaline. Or on the positive side, which helps us to see this stress can be positive or negative side, someone's on a roller coaster ride and they're going on one of those ones that just slowly takes you up, up, up. You're going up for a really, really long time. And then you get to the top and then you just dive straight down and you get that rush of feeling like you're falling, like you're going to die, but it's fun, it's engaging, it's enjoyable. Fine line between excitement and anxiety. And we were actually talking about that this morning, that there's these fine lines between some of the states that, you know, between pleasure and pain, between anxiety and excitement. And so in often the perception about an interpretation of how we relate to that experience, because a lot of people relate to the experience of a roller coaster as fun. But a lot of people relate to the experience of getting cut off in traffic as a problematic and unpleasant experience. But it's a similar feeling. So that's the feeling of catecholamines rushing and increasing at a very fast rate, and then they also quickly tend to flush out of the system. So if we're talking about the difference between catecholamines and cortisol, that can be a helpful thing that we can say that adrenaline rush that you get from these types of experiences is more the catecholamine side versus more of a persistent and chronic type of a feeling, either wired or depleted, can be more of the cortisol side. So always good to understand, how do we talk to clients and how do we bring that these concepts into their direct experience so they can get on board with what we're saying. And, oh yeah, I get that. I understand that. What can I do now?
So we talked about a little bit of this already with the connection to the amygdala. The other component of this though is LPS, lipopolysaccharides that we know are part of gram-negative bacteria. They stimulate the subiculum. And we can actually see in research that we can get a trigger of catecholamine release through LPS. And that's because, probably, mechanism action-wise, because it actually is going to stimulate the subiculum, which is then connected to the adrenal medulla. So this is already a connection of how bacteria that we see in our gastrointestinal tract, for example, can activate the adrenal medulla and actually contribute to the stress response. So very, very cool information.
So that's the LPS, stimulants the subiculum still of the hypothalamus?
The hippocampus.
Hippocampus.
The LPS stimulates the subiculum of the hippocampus.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Remember, the subiculum is connected to the amygdala as well as to the medulla. And then, so we see that catecholamines, the question too with the medulla is with the catecholamines, because we know the catecholamines don't cross the blood-brain barrier very easily. So the question is, well, what is happening there? And we can see that catecholamines, in particular dopamine, the precursor to norepinephrine and epinephrine, is a big trigger for satiety and hunger in our GI tract. We know we have a bunch of receptors in our GI tract. Doesn't feel 100% clear in the research all of the effects of dopamine, but it is thought that is part of the hunger and satiety effect. And then we also see that catecholamines play a role in the regulation of our cardiovascular system. So catecholamines are vasoconstrictors. They're going to constrict our blood vessels, change our heart rate, these sorts of things. So there, a lot of the actions that we're seeing with the catecholamines that are produced in the medulla are really working on the periphery.
And to be clear with the satiety, hunger in the GI tract, it's dopamine that we see that is produced by the adrenals, but we're wondering, well, is that doing something in the rest of the body because it doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier very well? L-DOPA will cross the blood-brain barrier a little better, but dopamine itself, there's dopamine produced within the brain that's going to be impactful as a neurotransmitter in the brain, but where's the dopamine from the adrenals going and what's it doing? And we're thinking, well, something about the GI tract, but not completely understood yet.
And that is coming from research, too. That's not just our idea, but even in research, it's a theory. So this is something that, according to what people are seeing in research around it, not crossing the blood-brain barrier easily, here's a theory as to exactly what it's doing. Just understand where that's coming from.
So corticoadrenal hormones, we're going to talk about dehydroepiandrosterone, or DHEA. And it's anabolic, so catabolic breaks things down, anabolic builds things up. It has this general overall, if we're looking at what's its big picture function, it's building things up. And so what types of things is it building up? Well, bone remodeling is something that DHEA can help with, so building bones. And so we want to be thinking about DHEA in relationship to osteoporosis, osteopenia. Then we also want to think about, well, immune connection, because that cortisol excess we know can dysregulate the immune system and suppress. DHEA can help reverse it. This is part of the reason why a DHEA cortisol ratio is important to assess and look at, because cortisol has that catabolic, DHEA has that anabolic, they have a relationship together.
I'm just thinking about the bones. So I have an osteoporosis client that I've been working with for 18 months or so, and she's making some good progress around the ward. Her DEXA scan was stable, didn't get worse.
Good.
And then her last Dutch report, her DHEA was high. And I'm wondering if that's I wasn't really sure what to think about that. I was thinking it was a stress response, really, because she's kind of stressed out. But I'm wondering if that's her bones trying to rebuild. Is there possibly a connection to that?
So the question is, somebody who's you're treating for osteoporosis and the DEXA is staying pretty consistent and then getting a Dutch back and seeing that the DHEA was elevated, and why is that? Is that a product of the bone trying to rebuild? It could be. I mean, I don't know that I've seen any research saying, say, the stimulation of osteoblasts in the bones to build them is going to directly trigger. Mm-hmm. I haven't looked at like that connection between the signal from the bone to, say, the adrenals is an interesting question.
Did you get also testosterone, dehydrotestosterone, 5-alpha?
Mm-hmm.
Were those elevated?
I have to go back and look at those. No, they weren't. Actually, as I recall, her testosterone was low. I'll have to look it up tonight. I believe that her testosterone was low, DHEA was high, and her estrogens were all still too low, so we're working on those. But
okay, so DHEA high, but testosterone low.
I think so, yeah.
So we could look at the enzyme that converts DHEA to testosterone,
mm-hmm,
as, you know, one thing to consider in that case. And it'd be good to get a sense for what the DHEA S, so the Dutch does the the total DHEA, and then it does the DHEAS independently.
I can't remember which was which. I'll have to look it up.
Yeah, it'd be good to sort of differentiate between those two, because that's good to understand as well. And sometimes it's good to also get a blood DHEAS, because they don't always correlate perfectly, as we've done some testing on like the same day with Dutch and blood tests, and it's good to get both, because they're not always perfect correlations. So we want to see sort of what's in the blood, what's in the urine, and get assessment of both if we can before jumping to too many conclusions about something that looks high or out of range.
So, and the other thing, of course, with that is, you know, I think it's interesting to look at osteoblastic and osteoclastic activity around DHEA and the signal for the bone repair and breakdown and its effect on DHEA. Might be an interesting question to look in the research. And it's also important to remember all the other things that are going to be needed to build bone. So,
right.
You know, so looking at if it's working, if it's not working, yes, that's an interesting question on DHEA. And what are all the nutrients, for example, you know, what are they doing? What is estrogen doing?
Mm-hmm.
So making sure we're really incorporating all the other ideas into that question too.
Yeah.
And then I want to add to, can reverse immune suppression due to cortisol excess? There's also a lot of research with DHEA and autoimmune conditions. So we don't want to just think of one way with the immune system. We want to think of a regulatory effect on the immune system with DHEA. Some of the research on DHEA and autoimmune supplements, very, very, very high doses of DHEA. And so it's a little bit interesting. Maybe very high levels of DHEA have a stronger immunoregulatory effect. I don't think it's completely understood the mechanisms, but we do see that it's well researched for autoimmune conditions in high doses.
And then also helping converting to estrogen and testosterone, so that's a natural pathway, and then converting that thyroid 4 to thyroid 3, T4 to T3. So we're going to see, we're not going to spend tons of time on the thyroid today, but the adrenals and the thyroid are very, very closely related. So we'll look at some of those relationships. One of them is with DHEA. So it's a pretty classical thing that we see on thyroid labs that we'll see a little bit functionally low free T3. A little bit debated in the functional community what the low is. The bottom that I've tended to use for functionally low T3, free T3, is 3.0. So some people like it a little bit higher, even like 3.2, 3.3, but somewhere in that range is a good kind of functional idea to have. So if we're seeing that we're not having that functional T3, and we're seeing that T4 values are, that free T4 values are normal, one reason we might want to consider, we might want to look at, is what is DHEA doing? And making sure that we're getting that DHEA level up for that conversion.
And what is cortisol doing? Because later we'll see that cortisol also can inhibit that T4, T3 conversion.
Yeah. So cortisol, opposite of DHEA. So DHEA was very anabolic, very building. Cortisol we find to be very catabolic, it's going to break down. We're going to see that it's used for energy. So most of us know that. And that affects blood glucose levels. So remember, it's a glucocorticoid, so it will raise, it'll have an effect on the liver and on the metabolite, the metabolism of glucose, allowing things like gluconeogenesis to be upregulated. So we end up having more blood glucose in the serum. And from that mechanism, we can wind up getting blood sugar abnormalities, hyperglycemia, diabetes.
And I'll add that it responds to inflammatory signals, and there's sort of a bidirectional effect that it can have on inflammation, which we'll talk more about later.
So the production of cortisol and DHEA is from cortisol.
From cholesterol.
I'm sorry, from cholesterol.
Yes, cortisol is made from cortisol.
Yeah, do you guys confuse yet? So cortisol is made from cholesterol, as is DHEA, and most of it's going to be created through acetase and pancethenic acid in the liver, and most cholesterol is. And then what's going to happen is the cholesterol is going to travel through the body, and the adrenal glands are going to uptake the cholesterol through their HDL receptors. Now the caveat I want to put in here is I read a bunch of studies about, is it HDL or LDL is more of what's the transport vehicle for cholesterol, what in the adrenal glands, what are those receptors? every single study I read, except for one, found that it was HDL receptors that were used for the adrenals to uptake cholesterol. There was one study out there that actually found the opposite. So just to throw that out there, that there is, you know, there is one study that actually found that LDLs were more utilized for adrenal hormones. But it's seeming through the research that since so many people are verifying this HDL, that it's more likely the HDL receptors at the adrenal glands that are uptaking the cholesterol.
So reassessing the notion of pregnenolone steel. So here we're going to talk about why that notion might have been a misconception and what the physiology is telling us that we understand now. So basically, pregnenolone is a precursor to both cortisol and DHEA. And the pregnenolone steel theory has the idea that because it's a precursor to both cortisol and DHEA, that it could decide to go either towards cortisol or towards DHEA, and that perhaps the body might be deciding to favor cortisol or favor DHEA production from that same root pregnenolone based on whether we're more dealing with stress and survival, shunting it down the cortisol pathway, or whether we're dealing more with being safe and relaxed so that we can focus a little more on reproduction and reproductive hormones and shunting it down the DHEA pathway. It's a very nice way to say, oh, is the body prioritizing survival or reproduction? And, you know, it makes sense from an evolutionary perspective that during times of stress, we might not want to reproduce, and that now that doesn't make so much sense because we can be under stress and be safe. But from an evolutionary perspective, a lot of the stresses might have been things like a hard winter where there's not enough food, not a good time to reproduce, or times when we're dealing with needing to leave our home and build a new structure elsewhere, or dealing with wild animals or things like that. And those are times when reproduction is probably less than optimal. So it's a nice theory in that it really seems to make sense from an evolutionary perspective, but when we dive deeper into the physiology, deeper investigation shows us that it contradicts that pregnenolone steel is an accurate idea about what's happening, because basically we have these three zones of the adrenals, and each zone has specialized cells that only make one kind of hormone. So remember, the zona reticularis makes that DHEA. So we have the specialized zones that make certain hormones, and there's no pool of pregnenolone that is used in the different zones. It's cholesterol that enters the cell. Basically, cholesterol enters a zone and then enters a cell in that zone. So let's say it's in the zona reticularis. It enters a cell in that zone. It enters into the mitochondria of the cell. That's where cholesterol converts to pregnenolone, in the mitochondria of a cell. Then it stays within that cell, and it's converted to whatever hormone it's being converted to, in the case of the zona reticularis, DHEA, in the endoplasmic reticulum of that cell. So it's still in the same cell. It doesn't leave the cell and go to a different zone and then go into a different hormone. And so basically what happens to pregnenolone is predetermined by the enzymes of the specialized cell that cholesterol entered and converted in the mitochondria of that cell into pregnenolone. That's the enzymes that are in that cell are basically determining what pregnenolone is going to become.
So do you guys see what's happening here? Why, once we have pregnenolone in a particular zone that has been created from cholesterol in the mitochondria of the cell, it's not pregnenolone that's even being dispersed between what zone. It's really cholesterol that's being dispersed between each zone. And that's moving into that mitochondria becoming pregnenolone, and that's when it's determining what hormone it's going to be. So there's not this idea of saying, well, I'm going to steal your pregnenolone and use it for my needs. Doesn't really hold up because it's already in the cell. It's already in the mitochondria.
So it's really, it's cholesterol that could become either one. Both of them become pregnenolone as part of the trajectory of where they're going, but pregnenolone is a midway step that's already predestined to become something based on the enzymes in those cells. And so pregnenolone steel is a misnomer. And it brings up the question of, if we supplement with pregnenolone, what's that really doing? We'll talk about that later.
And then what's causing the imbalance in the other sex hormones?
So we have a couple
right.
theories there,
yeah.
too.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And why would cortisol dysregulation lead to DHEA dysregulation if these are different, distinct zones and we don't have this common pool of pregnenolone that's deciding which one to go to? We don't have this limited number of, you know, pregnenolone available to decide where it's going. So,
mm-hmm.
so it does, we need to reassess the ideas about the physiology of stress. So this chart's helpful. This is going to really help us to understand why this is a more accurate, basically hormone cascade than the ones that we've sort of seen and used in the past. So we see the zona glomerulosa, the cholesterol that enters that cell becomes pregnenolone, yes, but then it's this already has a specialized cell in the endoplasmic reticulum to convert it to progesterone and then down to aldosterone. The zona fasciculata has a specialized cell that converts it down to either corticosterone or cortisol. More cortisol in humans, more corticosterone in rats. So if you look at mice and rat studies, you're going to see a lot of talk of corticosterone because they produce a majority of that. We produce a majority of cortisol. So when we hear corticosterone in research, we need to think, okay, that's equivalent to, that would more be doing cortisol in humans.
So this is one of what we're looking at. This is one of the theories that we have as far as the relationship between the sex hormones. If we look at this zona fasciculata, we see that pregnenolone does split, and here it's at progesterone, and here it's at cortisol. So it's possible, theoretically, with what we know in the research right now, that we could still favor stress and fight or flight over reproduction from a
progesterone
standpoint. So we know that, say, if progesterone, if everything in this pathway was shunted as pregnenolone goes to cortisol instead of going to progesterone, it's theoretically possible that we could lower our progesterone and therefore have an estrogen dominant state. But it's not because the pregnenolone is being stolen from these different zones.
And the 17-OH progesterone might also be moving down towards the cortisol. And then the zona reticularis, we see that cholesterol becoming pregnenolone but staying in the cell, and the endoplasmic reticulum becoming the 17-OH pregnenolone and then DHEA, and then oftentimes the storage form of DHEA, which is DHEAS, and then there can be a minor product of androstenedione, which I believe is one of the ones that's measured on the Dutch test.
Mm-hmm.
Cool, right?
Yeah.
So that really gives us a whole different way of starting to think about the physiology of stress from what's been perpetuated in the integrative community for a long time. And so we need to contemplate that, think about that, see how that impacts the way that we think about stress in our own bodies, how we explain stress to clients, and how we work with HPA axis dysregulation. So, like we said, the immediate question comes up, what about supplementing pregnenolone? So we'll talk about that. But other questions might come up. So bring up questions as they arise, and we'll address and assess them. We've already got the pregnenolone thing to bring up in the treatment section.
So here's a study that will also explain a little bit about adrenals and female hormone imbalances. Is a study looked at menopause-related covariates, including estrone, glucuronide, FSH, testosterone, and found that they were all significantly increased within overnight cortisol levels. So when we looked at further about menopause reaction, or menopause and cortisol, the relationship, we found is elevated. There was a lot of overnight cortisol levels that were happening with menopause. So one idea in research right now is that part of hot flashes, why hot flashes are tend to be worse for night at, for women, is even deeper than just saying be deficient in things like estradiol, but it's also because of the cortisol levels being elevated. So the thought is that that's actually contributing to the hot flashes, which is interesting because a lot of previous talk has been around cortisol levels being low with menopause, about menopause being so bad because of possible adrenal fatigue. And, you know, as we redefine the adrenal gland, we're saying, oh, well, maybe there could be lower total cortisol levels. That might be possible. But a significant amount of menopause women are having increases, at least in the middle of the night.
Do you think that's also because their blood sugar drops?
It could be. It absolutely could be. I mean,
we're
definitely... The
question is whether it's... Potentially also because the blood sugar drops.
Yeah, I mean, certainly blood sugar dropping is going to raise cortisol levels. But to say that, you know, majority of menopausal women have low blood sugar, I mean, it'd be an important thing in a research thing to exclude, to make sure that glucose levels were normal, to make sure that we're really getting good information. But there's definitely several studies out there that are finding this whole increase with menopause. So my suspect is it's something to do with the menopausal changes. And I think blood sugar would be something that could make it better or worse depending on what the glucose levels were.
So HPA axis. So we really need to understand the HPA axis because we're really going to be focusing more on that than the adrenals alone. And so the very basics of the HPA axis, which is going to be reviewed for most people, is that stress can hit the hypothalamus and stimulate the hypothalamus to produce more CRH. And CRH stimulates the pituitary to bind to the pituitary, and the pituitary in response produces more and secretes more ACTH. ACTH then hits the adrenal cortex and stimulates the production of cortisol. And cortisol then should have a negative feedback loop in health to basically bind to the glucocorticoid receptors on the hypothalamus, and the pituitary, we'll get to that later, to signal the hypothalamus that, okay, cortisol levels have raised, so you can stop that CRH increase and downregulate a little bit, to stimulate the pituitary, to downregulate the ACTH a little bit, to stimulate the adrenal cortex, to downregulate the cortisol a little bit. So that's a feedback loop. But stress kind of overrides that feedback loop a little bit, and stress kind of takes that feedback loop and makes excessive amounts of cortisol to deal with those stresses in the beginning, at least. And we'll talk about how that can, if stress becomes chronic, dysregulate the HPA axis into potentially a chronic state of either elevated or depressed cortisol. But the healthy expression is that stress impacts this system to make more cortisol. Cortisol helps us deal with the stress, and that cortisol then feeds back once the stress is over to the hypothalamus to calm that cortisol response down.
The other thing to make note of here with this HPA axis picture is the medulla. We're going to get more detailed into how the medulla and the cortex are related in a little while. There is a relationship between the cortex and the medulla talking. There's also hypothalamic control through the release of vasopressin. So we'll go through that in more detail in a little while.
And then for the part of the thyroid connection, we see cortisol can inhibit TSH and T4, T3 conversion, and CRH can also inhibit TSH. And so we see that this, of course, stress also can hit the hypothalamus for the HPT axis and may impact TRH. The pituitary then signals TSH to the thyroid to make T4, which gets converted to T3, a little bit in the thyroid, a lot in other tissues in the body, and then that can then go into the mitochondria of the cell and have its impact on the cells to give us energy and stimulate metabolism.
So this is part here as far as cortisol inhibiting the T4 to T3 conversion. That's going to be pretty logical, right? Because we inhibit that, we're going to have less T3. We're not in this state of high metabolism, and we're not in this state of building, of growing, of moving. But DHEA, remember, is going to activate that. So we're always talking about how cortisol and DHEA kind of have this opposing and balancing type of relationship. And we see that a little bit here when we see that cortisol inhibits that conversion and DHEA upregulates it.
So this is the really basic understanding. We're going to get into a lot more detail of how there's many other variables that play into this picture. And we're going to understand a little bit about especially the glucocorticoid receptors and what happens to them in relationship to stress and how that really makes us understand this picture a lot better.
Just one more question on thyroid. So with that inhibition from CRH and from cortisol, will you see TSH actually low on labs?
So with inhibition from CRH and cortisol, can we see TSH low on labs? And it's a good question. The cortisol dysregulation can go both ways, I think, on TSH. But if we think, what is TSH? Well, it's thyroid stimulating hormone. If it goes down, it's going to stimulate less thyroid hormone to be present in the body. So it may be that some cortisol dysregulation could lead to TSH levels looking normal but depressed T4, T3 levels, because that depressed stimulation, it might not get low, but it might get lower than would be adequate for the signal needed for T4 production. But I haven't seen tons of sort of solid research about exactly what it's doing and how much. Have you?
I haven't, no. I mean, there's not been research that I have seen that says if cortisol is depressed, or if cortisol stays elevated to this level, we would likely see TSH inhibited to this level. There does seem to be enough research around the relationship of the adrenals and the thyroid and TSH. For me to feel like anytime we're seeing a altercation in TSH levels, that we should consider that the adrenal hormones are part of the picture. It doesn't necessarily seem clear as far as the level that there could be involved, but certainly that they could be involved is pretty clear.
Well, and especially if we see that, as we often do when we do functional thyroid assessments, and we get TSH as well as free T4, free T3, reverse T3, and the antibodies, then we're starting to really get this big, good picture of what's happening. And sometimes we do see TSH looks normal, but there's inadequate T4 and or T3 available to the cells. And so we also see cortisol increasing the reverse T3, which then binds to the T3 receptor sites and makes the free T3 that's not reverse T3 less available and accessible to the cells. And so, like, for example, I just looked at a lab this week, and I saw that the TSH looked normal. So if a doc just ran TSH, they wouldn't be alarmed at all. The free T3 was functionally just slightly low. It was about a 2.7. We'd like to see it around 3 to 4. So that's already thinking, well, maybe a little bit of subclinical, probably not too bad, but maybe a little subclinical hypo. But then the reverse T3 was elevated. Mm-hmm. So now I'm thinking, okay, this already functionally just slightly low, still in range, but slightly low T3 level is getting impacted by an excessive reverse T3. So that's a picture where I'm thinking cortisol. I'm thinking other things too, but I'm definitely thinking cortisol in addition to some of the nutrients needed for T4, T3 conversion, and some other things.